Hello and welcome to the Health Report with me, Norman Swan. 1 in 10 Australians suffer from osteoarthritis. The comedian Will Anderson is an example of a relatively young person with a condition that has an extraordinary number of myths, not least being that there's nothing much you can do about it. In this highlight of the year from the Health Report, we'll give you some information about surprising ways that osteoarthritis can be prevented, how unnecessary tests and surgery can be avoided, and advice on what treatments work. Australia's leading authority on osteoarthritis is David Hunter, who's Professor of Rheumatology at the University of Sydney.
Osteoarthritis is a painful condition that typically affects knees, hips, or hands, and it's the most common reason a person develops lower limb disability. It relates oftentimes to structural changes that occur within the bone, the lining of the joint, the synovium, and cartilage.
When I was at medical school, it was called a degenerative disease. Nothing to do with inflammation, just you're falling apart as you were aging. It's a bit different now, isn't it?
I guess the prehistoric theories are very different to the
Thank
modern theories.
Thank you very much, Professor Hunter.
The prehistoric theories were around in the Jurassic period when I was at medical school as well. But it was very much a cartilage-centric condition known as wear and tear or degenerative, similar to the terms that are commonly used these days. But they're all wrong. I think it's really important that people conceptualize this as a dynamic condition. Every joint has the capacity for repair. So this isn't just wear and degeneration. It isn't just old age. We have teenagers that develop osteoarthritis. So we think of this as a dynamic change where the reparative processes are overwhelmed by destructive processes that oftentimes relate to injury, overweight, and other mechanical load factors.
Just mechanical load factors? Because you get it in the hands. What's mechanical load about the hands?
Not just mechanical load factors, but mechanical load factors by far and away overwhelm most of the other factors. So the mechanical factors we often hear about are often injury and overload due to weight. But there are also, particularly in the hands, other risk factors. So genes plays an important role. About 50% of a person's likelihood of developing hand osteoarthritis relates to familial predisposition. Occupation plays a role. So if you are involved in operating jackhammers or heavy machinery, you're more predisposed to hand osteoarthritis. But interestingly, there are also circulating molecules that come from fat that play a role in why a person develops hand osteoarthritis as well, and inflammation in joints.
So this is a story we've covered before, namely that when you have a lot of fat in your body, your immune system is a bit turned on in terms of inflammation. So, for example, there's no obesity load on your hands, but you're more likely to get sore osteoarthritic hands if you're fatter.
You're 30% more likely to get hand osteoarthritis if you're obese, primarily thought to be due to that upregulation of inflammation due to those circulating molecules in an obese person.
Does that mean losing weight makes it better?
We don't know that yet, but there are a couple of studies going on right now to test that theory.
What other myths are there about osteoarthritis?
There are lots of myths about osteoarthritis. I think a lot of people believe that there are only so many steps a joint has in its lifetime. So the more steps you take, the more likely you are to develop osteoarthritis. And the opposite is probably true. The more active you remain, probably the better your joints are. A lot of people believe that this can't be cured. And at this point in time, that's probably the case. And people oftentimes say that surgery is the only way to fix this. But there's a lot of other treatments besides surgery. A lot of other people believe that you're going to automatically end up in a wheelchair as a consequence of developing osteoarthritis in a joint. But I think it's incredibly important people see this as a treatable condition and they don't just look at this as something that's going to malinger them into old age and leave them completely disabled.
So I once had a knee surgeon on the program who claimed that the reason why we have very high knee joint replacement rates in Australia is that we're grinding our knees to dust with all this jogging that we're doing. Is that true?
Definitely not true. Completely false. So there's good studies out there now showing that exercise and running included in that exercise is likely helpful in terms of preventing the risk of osteoarthritis. A great study in a recent physiotherapy journal that suggests that the more sedentary you are, the greater the risk. But if you increase your activity levels, including through running, you reduce your risk substantially. For those people who are elite performers, and there I'm talking about marathon runners, you potentially place yourself at some risk. But if you're a recreational runner, if you do it at loads that aren't excessive, then you are likely protecting yourself from the development of osteoarthritis. So there's no good substantiation of the theory that running is bad for your joints. It's actually likely helpful.
What if you already have osteoarthritis? Because a lot of people stop running because they've got it.
If you're a runner and you develop osteoarthritis, or if you've got osteoarthritis and you want to take up running, the data is a bit conflicting. So there's good data suggesting that high impact load potentially leads to exacerbations or flares of pain, potentially flares of inflammation in that context. But there's some observational study data suggesting that those people who are able to maintain running, their function long-term is likely better as a consequence of them being able to do that compared to people with osteoarthritis who don't run.
Occupation, you say, is a cause. I mean, farmers get knee osteoarthritis probably more than other people. Women get knee osteoarthritis more than men. And there's also a sports-related injury story here too. So let's take those one by one. Occupation, you've talked about the jackhammer and hand osteoarthritis. What occupations and why increase the risk of some joint osteoarthritis?
For knee osteoarthritis, the occupations that place a person at greater risk are those that involve knee flexion under load. So there we think about particularly painters, carpet layers, other construction workers who are going up and down ladders and stairwells with load, with their knee bent, places them at greater risk of knee osteoarthritis. For hip osteoarthritis, farmers are predisposed to hip osteoarthritis, likely again because of load, oftentimes in a compromised position with the hip at extreme angles. From the perspective of injury, we know that if you tear your cruciate ligament, one of the main stabilizing ligaments in the knee, or your meniscus, you're likely to develop knee osteoarthritis within 10 to 15 years of that injury. And the shame here is that this occurs the median age of about 25 years in most people. So they're developing knee osteoarthritis within their mid to late 30s. Surgery to repair the cruciate ligament, if you don't have instability, is probably unnecessary. And it doesn't appear to change a person's long-term risk of osteoarthritis development. The best way to prevent this from occurring is to teach people who are playing sports to land on their knee properly. About 70% of ACL, cruciate ligament injuries, occur through non-contact, where the knee lands at an inappropriate angle and places the cruciate at risk of rupture.
What's the correct way to land on your knee or to land on your feet to not stress the knee? I mean, netball has been constantly said as the knee surgeon's friend here because it's a dreadful sport for putting huge pressure on your knee.
Netball, unfortunately, if they introduced a one-step rule and allowed people to take one more step, they'd probably put a lot less stress through their knee. But they're probably not likely to change the rules. So if they were to enable people to land or teach people how to land on their knee properly, with their knee landing so that it doesn't buckle in under them, bringing the knees closer together, but rather with the knees appropriately neutrally aligned directly between the hip and the ankle, it's likely to lead to, and has in Scandinavian countries, reducing injury rates by about 70% in national level.
And what would be the impact on, say, knee joint replacement later on in life?
If we were to eliminate the risk of knee injury completely, we would reduce the number of people developing knee osteoarthritis by 20%.
20%? That's huge.
It's massive. It's massive. And unfortunately, at this point in time, whilst elite level players get taught this neuromuscular training, which is mandated by the FIFA 11 program and the PET program and the IOC, most grassroots level sporting players and coaches don't get introduced to this concept.
So schoolboy, schoolgirl and club sport. It
doesn't happen.
How much would it cost to train coaches in this technique?
We did some modelling of this relatively recently with the Australian Orthopaedic Association, and nationally, if the Australian Sports Commission were to take this on as part of their coaches and trainers program, it would probably cost in the order of $1 to $2 million a year from an educational perspective. But the cost savings that would extend from that would be in the order of $100 to $120 million a year by reducing ACL reconstruction surgery, arthroscopies, and subsequent joint replacements.
So let's move to diagnosis, because we spend a fortune in this country on diagnosing osteoarthritis. And I think you're one of the people who say we're spending too much money on it.
We are spending an inordinate amount on something that should be so simple. Diagnosing osteoarthritis is about a story, a history taken from a doctor, and presenting symptoms of pain, limited function, and doing a simple examination of the joint to see whether there's joint line tenderness and or some swelling to confirm that.
So when you say limited function, you really mean stiffness?
Limitations in a person's ability to go for a walk, put their shoes and socks on, go up and down stairs, get in and out of a car, those sorts of things. But to make a diagnosis.
So how does the doctor know it's not something more serious like rheumatoid arthritis, for example?
So if a doctor takes an appropriate history and does an appropriate examination, they'll be able to rule out typically the salient features of inflammatory arthritis. For rheumatoid arthritis, typically a person's going to have a lot of stiffness in the morning, a lot of joint swelling. Typically, it'll be small joints in the periphery, the hands and the toes that are primarily affected, as opposed to commonly what happens in osteoarthritis is the large joints. So a simple history and examination is typically sufficient to rule that out. And if the doctor's concerned about there being a potential alternative diagnosis, a simple blood test might be sufficient. But in most instances for osteoarthritis, we don't need blood tests, we don't need x-rays, we don't need MRIs to rule out these other diagnoses. It's quite simple and straightforward to do this based on a history and examination. And it wastes a lot of money. And it also places people at greater risk.
Greater risk of unnecessary interventions because you get scared by the x-ray.
Exactly. Most MRIs in your or my age, so this is people who are 50 or above, are going to reveal a meniscal tear.
Regardless of whether you've got a sore knee or not.
Exactly. 65% of people in the general community without knee osteoarthritis will have a torn meniscus. It just happens as part and parcel of us growing older. In osteoarthritis, it's about 98% of people will have a meniscal tear. It's important people understand that that torn meniscus doesn't contain nerve fibers at that age. So it can't be responsible for why a person presents complaining of pain. If you've got a locked knee, maybe, but not pain. Unfortunately, they see the MRI, they see the tear in the meniscus, and the automatic response to that is, well, doctor, you need to fix it. And the response from the orthopedic surgeon is often to trim that away. And that accelerates the rate of progression of osteoarthritis and shortens the time to joint replacement.
So is there any role for imaging?
There is a role for imaging if you are unclear about the diagnosis or if you need to stage a person's joint prior to them having surgery. Outside of those contexts, it has no role in the management of osteoarthritis because it doesn't change what I, as a doctor, might do to you as a patient.
And for knee osteoarthritis, that's simply you stand and they take a standing x-ray of your knees.
Correct. And it's really important it be a standing weight-bearing x-ray to actually do it properly. But again, in most instances, it's completely unnecessary.
You're listening to The Health Report here on RN, ABC News and CBC Radio across Canada. And I'm talking to Professor David Hunter, who's Professor of Rheumatology at the University of Sydney. And you wanted to say some more about prevention, David.
So the biggest number one risk factor for developing osteoarthritis is overweight and obesity. And that accounts for between 45 and 50% of a person's likelihood of developing osteoarthritis of the knee. If we reduce the average weight in the community by 5 kilograms, we would reduce the number of people who develop osteoarthritis by a third.
A third?
Yeah.
So we're gaining 20% if you actually teach coaches neuromuscular training, and another third if you lose 5 kilos.
Yeah.
So 5% of your body weight, perhaps 7%.
Yeah. The majority of people in the community that develop osteoarthritis don't need to. The risks are modifiable.
Okay, so treatment. Now, before we get to drugs, we spoke about exercise. Is there any evidence for physiotherapy, specific exercises to actually improve things?
The mainstay of treatment for everybody that has osteoarthritis should consist of three fundamental things. Exercise, and I'll come back to the types of exercise in a minute. Weight management for the 95% of people that have osteoarthritis that are overweight or obese, and then teaching them how to self-manage their disease. And that needs to be the core management for everybody that has osteoarthritis.
And what about diet? There are diets like the Mediterranean diet, which probably reduce your inflammation load. Is there any evidence that diet makes a difference?
Outside of reducing weight, the evidence is limited. So there's probably some benefit from a Mediterranean diet by enriching omega-3 fatty acids and reducing, hopefully, omega-6 fatty acids, which are pro-inflammatory. Outside of that, people believe, but there's not good data from trials to suggest that vitamin D might also play an important role. But the key dietary manipulation is really caloric restriction and weight loss.
Okay, let's go to exercise.
The key interventions for exercise are strengthening exercise of the muscles either side of the joint to improve the joint stability. There is also some good evidence to suggest that aerobic conditioning, particularly by facilitating some of the weight loss, is also helpful. And when a person does exercise, I think it's critical that they do it in a way that long-term they're likely to adhere to it, to stick to it. And so we generally recommend low-impact exercise for the aerobic conditioning portion. So things like swimming, cycling, tai chi, rowing, paddling sports.
And self-management?
Self-management. So basically teaching people about what the disease is, about what its prognosis is, that they're not going to end up in a wheelchair, that they can continue to walk and remain active, then it's really important for their general health.
So stop being scared and start being hopeful.
Exactly. Putting some of those misconceptions to bed and then teaching them how they can deal with flares of their disease. The overwhelming majority of people who have osteoarthritis will get an exacerbation of their symptoms that will last oftentimes for 2 to 3 days on oftentimes a monthly basis. So giving them the principles and techniques that they can then subsequently manage that themselves.
Do any medications help?
Yes. So there are some medications that are helpful for symptoms. And from the hierarchy of guideline evidence, what we would suggest that helps most would be the anti-inflammatory group of medications.
So ibuprofen type drugs.
Exactly. Voltaren, Feldene, ibuprofen. I think it's really important that people recognize that these drugs are effective at relieving symptoms, but they do carry with them the risks and other side effects. The major risk that we worry about is gastrointestinal, the development of ulcers in the gut. And in a person who's at risk of that, we would like to start with a topical anti-inflammatory. And in Australia, we have Voltaren and Feldene available to us.
This isn't a cream that you rub on the joint.
Exactly.
And that works?
Yeah. 2 to 3 times a day, it appears to be as effective as the oral formulation.
With fewer side effects?
With very limited side effects, other than some topical irritation.
What about steroid injections into the knee? I noticed there was a recent trial of that which suggested they make the knee worse.
A one-off steroid injection into a painful knee is probably not a bad thing. And there's some evidence to suggest that it's helpful in terms of reducing a person's symptoms for a mean duration of about 2 to 4 weeks. I think it's important that we put the fact that the typical disease duration for a person with osteoarthritis is about 25 to 27 years. So you can get a 2 to 4 week benefit from a one-off steroid shot. The recent trial that just came out suggested that steroid injections every 3 months for a 2-year period did not improve the symptoms at the end of 2 years, but was also, there was a suggestion that it was potentially harmful from the perspective of facilitating increased structural loss in the cartilage that was measured on MRI.
So a one-off and not to be repeated. Now let's go to, first of all, arthroscopy. We've seen knee arthroscopy rates going down for osteoarthritis in people aged over 50 in Australia, although in some parts of the country like South Australia, it seems to be pretty high still, but there's no benefit. We'll go with that. But I've noticed that there's now a switch for orthopaedic surgeons to do hip arthroscopy. What's the story there?
Let's talk about knee arthroscopy first and then come back to hip arthroscopy because I'm a little bit conflicted and I'll tell you why.
For knee, you just had one, have you?
I probably need one, but I haven't had one yet. For knee arthroscopy, the rates are going down. And I think in part, it's a credit to evidence getting out there to the community, to the people that probably shouldn't be having them. And also the leadership that's been thrown from the orthopedic community here and coming out with a position statement and trying to educate their colleagues about what shouldn't actually be happening. Despite that, there are still too many of them happening. You know, at best, our current knowledge would suggest in 2016, there are still about 30,000 knee arthroscopies for osteoarthritis that occurred in Australia at a cost to our healthcare system of about $5,000 a piece. So that's substantial. And as you suggested, it's a waste of money, but it also puts people at risk of other side effects, including clots in their legs, clots in their lungs, infection, and potentially death. So we shouldn't be doing this for osteoarthritis. We've known this for over a decade, but unfortunately it's still happening. But it's good that rates of those surgery are going down. So for hip arthroscopy, there's a wonderful theory, and it is a theory, that shape alterations in your hip are the main factor that determines whether you are likely to develop hip osteoarthritis long term. And it's a thing the medical community calls femoroacetabular impingement, and most other people can't pronounce it. So that's why we call it FAI for short. And there's some evidence from observational studies that about 85% of people who subsequently develop hip osteoarthritis have a shape abnormality that they probably develop when they're in their teenage years. And it's thought to be due to repetitive flexion, internal rotation activity. So a lot of people who play kicking sports and other loaded sports are much more likely at risk of developing these shape abnormalities. Some time ago, surgeons identified that this bump was the cause of these symptoms that people were developing called impingement. And decided, well, potentially that's something we can shave off. And theoretically, long-term, it might reduce your long-term risk of developing hip osteoarthritis. So that's why hip arthroscopy came about. Rates of hip arthroscopy have been going up exponentially. And at this point in time, the evidence to support that from randomized trials is limited. My conflict starts because about 4 years ago, we submitted a grant to the National Health and Medical Research Council to test to see whether this type of surgery was any better than physiotherapy, structurally and biomechanically. What we were trying to identify is the surgery making a difference to this person's long-term risk of developing hip osteoarthritis? Partway through the study, the Medicare item number, the MBS item number for hip arthroscopy got removed. So our ability to do this study automatically went down substantially. So we've got some money from the government to do the study. And on the other hand, they take the money away to allow us to do the study on the other hand.
Because there's no incentive for the orthopaedic surgeons to do the procedure.
Yeah, so it's become quite challenging to develop the evidence base. But I think it's really important that we put this into context. Like many other things in medicine, there is longitudinal case series type data, which isn't randomized controlled trial data, suggesting that this is helpful. Admittedly, it's not blinded, it's not an appropriate comparison. We needed to do the trial in order to generate the evidence, but our ability to do the trial is now markedly limited as a consequence. So there's my conflict. Do I think hip arthroscopy works? I honestly don't know, and that's why we decided to do the trial.
Let's go now to hip and joint replacements, very effective operations for people who need them. But I think you argue that we're not necessarily doing them in everybody who needs them. When do you need a hip or joint or knee replacement, and can you avoid it or delay it?
For most people who have osteoarthritis, it shouldn't be the first thing that you consider as a means of management. If you have persistent pain, limited function, and particularly nighttime pain, despite all of the other treatments that we've spoken about already, so that includes weight loss, exercise, use of appropriate medication to control your symptoms, and those things are still limiting your lifestyle, then it's worthwhile going along to a surgeon and having a conversation about whether you are an appropriate candidate for surgery. The unfortunate thing is that about 80% of patients who are dealt with in primary care in Australia follow a course of, they're given an analgesic medication, so that's your anti-inflammatories or paracetamol. You've skipped the exercise and diet, and when the analgesic medication is no longer sufficient, you're referred to a surgeon. Referral to a surgeon is 5 times more common than referral to a physiotherapist or a dietitian, someone who can help you with the exercise or weight loss. The other problem in our system, and you know, I'm a huge fan of joint replacement. I think for the right patient at the right time, it's a wonderful procedure. Unfortunately, the way the health system is structured in Australia places incentives around joint replacement and doesn't provide sufficient support for other types of management strategies. So the average person who has osteoarthritis has between 2 to 3 large joints affected. So that'll be 2 knees and a hip, for example. If we do a joint replacement on 1 knee, that costs our healthcare system in the order of $20,000 to $25,000 for 1 joint replacement. That then takes that person 6 to 12 months to recover from that surgery. So there's a lot of disability that occurs perioperatively as a consequence of the surgery.
It takes you a while to realize the benefits.
So there's a big cost there. If we appropriately reimbursed healthcare professionals who provided exercise and diet, it would cost in the order of $600 to $700 a year to manage a person who has osteoarthritis. Unfortunately, at this point in time, Medicare, whilst it reimburses for the joint replacement, provides you 5 visits to a physio or a dietitian or an orthotist or a psychologist to help you with the management of your osteoarthritis every year. So we're not appropriately supporting the allied healthcare professionals, the exercise and diet piece, but we are subsidizing appropriately joint replacement.
And how many, well, one way of looking at it is what proportion of people would be diverted from joint replacement or have it delayed? Because there's always more people to fill the slots, if you like, particularly in public waiting lists, if you actually instituted that sort of preventive or different management techniques.
Yeah, so I think the ideal process would be they would go along and see their GP. The GP would provide them a model of care that included seeing a physiotherapist, a dietitian, someone to facilitate weight loss, exercise, and these other strategies, and coordinated through the GP. And then if it became necessary, they'd go along and see their joint replacement surgeon. Unfortunately, at this point in time, we're bypassing most of those conservative options.
But do we know the percentage who could be diverted?
In late stage disease. So we've set programs up within New South Wales called the Osteoarthritis Chronic Care Program. And when we first
started, which also exists in other states as well by different names, where you go to a physiotherapist-led clinic before you go into a public waiting list.
Yeah. And in large part, that targeted people who were on joint replacement waiting lists, hip and knee joint replacement waiting lists. And in New South Wales, in those programs, about one in five people who were on a waiting list for a joint replacement decided during the course of that program of exercise and weight loss that they didn't want the surgery any longer. So even people who are at a late stage of disease, one in five decided that they are actually happy not to have the surgery.
And your argument would be even bigger if you're further upstream or earlier in your course.
Yeah, I think if we were to target people much earlier in the disease course, we are much more likely to see a larger effect and a bigger effect on the healthcare system similarly.
So there's enormous potential for gain here.
Enormous potential for gain. And, you know, again, some modelling that we've done recently around obesity would suggest that if we can reduce the number of people who are overweight by 10%, we would save annually $3 billion.
It's extraordinary. Now, we left the cure question till last. Is it curable?
I think osteoarthritis is completely preventable. And
That's not what I asked.
I'm avoiding the question. But so at this point
well,
in time...
Well, you raised it earlier, not me.
Well, I think it was Benjamin Franklin or some other smarter person than I was said an ounce of prevention is a whole lot better than a cure.
Sure.
From the perspective of cure, long term, I do think we are likely to be able to have treatments that restructure the joint and reduce a person's pain. And there is this group of drugs called disease-modifying osteoarthritis drugs that we're currently in the process of testing that appear to be effective at regenerating joint tissues and reducing pain. They're unlikely to come to the Australian market for a good 5 to 6 years. And they're likely to be available probably within the US within 2 to 3 years. And these will be injections a person gets into a joint maybe every once every 12 months that are likely to help regenerate joint tissues.
So these aren't stem cells?
Not at this point in time, despite whatever advertisements are occurring on radio stations about the benefits of stem cells. Stem cells, based on the existing stem cell technology, is unlikely to be helpful over and above a saltwater injection into your knee. So at this point in time, it's not worth the $10,000 per injection that are being charged, and you're much better spending that money on other treatments which are much more likely to be effective for your osteoarthritis.
And you're involved in one of these randomized trials?
We've done a randomized trial, and I've got one trial that's in the hopper, so to speak, at NHMRC, the National Health Medical Research Council, to see if that gets funded this year. Because I do think it's promising, and we've recently done a trial in China, a small pilot investigation that suggests that if you have a particular type of stem cell at a particular population concentration of stem cells, that it may be helpful both for symptoms and structure long term. But the way it's currently being done in Australia, it's taking people's money away and unfortunately giving them misperception about the benefits of a very costly treatment.
And I assume these new drugs, which you're also trialing, one of them you're also trialing, are going to be horribly expensive like all the new drugs are at the moment.
In the short term, most drugs will be expensive, but ultimately they'll all go off patent and the cost will come down substantially, but that may
take... You've just got to live long enough. And as we speak, you're recruiting?
Yes, yeah. We're recruiting for a trial at the moment, looking at an injectable for osteoarthritis. And if people are interested, they can go to the website, which is www.tlcbio.com. And it's a clinical trial that's just starting in Australia. There are 4 sites in Australia that are recruiting for this particular study. And it's of a new treatment that hasn't been tested before.
And it's sponsored by the drug company, which people need to know about.
It's sponsored by the drug company, and I don't receive money from the drug company other than to run the trial.
David Hunter, thank you for joining us on The Health Report.
Norman, thank you so much for having me.
David Hunter is Professor of Rheumatology at the University of Sydney and Royal North Shore Hospital. I'm Norman Swan, and this has been one of The Health Report's highlight episodes of the year. I'll see you next week in the new year.